Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. On today's show, we are discussing two of the week's top stories, the ongoing oil disaster and the Israeli commandos who rappelled onto and attacked the Gaza-bound flotillas. We will also discuss escalating violence and drone attacks in Pakistan and Afghanistan. But first off today, we'll discuss coverage of the Monday attacks on the Gaza-bound flotillas. For the first few days, the national media focused on what it called competing videos released by the Israeli government and activists with the Free Gaza movement. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting monitored national media and said much of the coverage has been, quote, remarkably unskeptical of Israel's account of events and their context and has paid little regard to international law. The report goes on to say that much of the U.S. press coverage takes Israeli government claims at face value and is based largely on footage made available by Israeli authorities. The majority of the 700 activists were released on Wednesday, and their accounts of what happened are now coming out. Paul Magot was on the ship covering the story for the Sydney Morning Herald. His firsthand account is called Terror on the Gaza Flotilla. He says his deportation was, quote, an absolute disrespect by Israel for democracy and the fundamental rights of journalists. Paul Magot is chief foreign correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald, and he will join us in just a minute from Istanbul. He just arrived there yesterday. We are also joined today by Rick Outson, publisher and editor of Independent News, the alternative news weekly for Northwest Florida. We are now getting reports that waves of gooey tar balls are crashing into the white sands of the Florida Hand Panhandle. Rick's following this closely. His latest piece is called BP's Windfall to the Rich. It's about a BP program to hire cleanup boats. Rather than hire boats from fishermen, the company is hiring boats owned by the wealthy. And Rick joins us from Florida. Hi, Rick. Where are you in Florida?
I'm in Pensacola.
Thank you. And I meant Florida Panhandle. I'm sorry. Someone was talking in my ear while I was talking about that. I should say that you wrote that piece for the Daily Beast. Thanks for joining us, Rick.
It's good to be here.
And we are also joined by Protop Chatterjee, senior editor of Corp Watch. Corp Watch investigates and exposes corporate violations of human rights, environmental crimes, fraud, and corruption around the world. Wired Magazine just reported that the United States is on a spending spree in Afghanistan. The U.S. military is spending hundreds of millions of dollars on wartime encampments. By one account, the U.S. has now 700 bases in Afghanistan. We'll talk with Protop about that, as well as escalating violence in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Hi, Protop. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we like to start off on a positive note. What did you both see this week that you thought was done well? And if you can be specific, that would be great. Protop, let's start with you.
Well, of course, I was fixated by the Gaza flotilla, and I wanted to say that there were some reporters that I thought did an outstanding job, as well as columnists. In particular, I wanted to single out Bradley Burston at Haaretz, who does a column called A Special Place in Hell. I also wanted to really commend Max Blumenthal for his report, Flotilla Raid Was Not Bungled. And the BBC, The Guardian did excellent live blogs. The New York Times coverage was shameful. Although Robert Mackey at the lead, I think, did a reasonable job. Democracy Now! Did a great job of interviewing Edward Peck. And some people that, you know, you look up to, like Elliot Spitzer, for all his crackdowns in corporate crime, was really uncritical of the IDF sort of propaganda videos without, you know, putting them into context. So, again, from my part, really kudos out to Max, to Bradley Burston, to Democracy Now!, the BBC, and Guardian.
And we're going to have Max Blumenthal on next Friday's show. You mentioned Elliot Spitzer, just to let listeners know, he is now hosting, filling in as a host on MSNBC, and he had, as a host, kind of a debate with Salon.com's Glenn Greenwald about this. And there's also some talk that he might get his own show on either MSNBC or CNN. And we'll link to that. And we'll talk about that, more coverage of this, in just a minute. Thanks for that, Protop. Rick Outson, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, you know, when you're sitting here on the precipice of a wave of oil coming on your shore, anything looks better than what you have to deal with this weekend. I think the thing that is that I've been most heartened by over the last week, particularly in dealing with BP and this disaster, is that we finally are seeing the Obama administration, as well as the state officials, understand that this is a true disaster. I think we've sort of buried our heads in the sand, and I think BP has got us convinced, or had certain officials convinced, that all this was going to be dealt with. And now we're starting to see what I've been asking for the past 5 weeks is outrage and anger, and understand that we have a major crisis on our hands, that it has to be dealt with. And I think we're starting to get the response that we need to have from the federal officials, as well as state and local officials, that this is a major crisis, and that there is no one that's going to take care of us except ourselves.
Mm-hmm. We're now getting reports that waves of gooey tar balls are crashing into the white sands of the Florida Panhandle.
That's true. It's starting to reach all along the white sands here. We have some of the most beautiful beaches in the world along the Florida Panhandle, sugar white beaches, and the tar balls are starting to show. We're getting reports of the fumes from the gasoline, for the crude oil, that's about a mile offshore now, is starting to overtake some people. We're getting reports of BP setting up, starting to contract with clinics to help workers with health issues. No one's willing to go on record yet, but I'm starting to get some reports of that. There's some serious health issues involved in this, and that's just now starting to surface.
And we've been talking about that for a few weeks, about some of the fishermen who've already been sent to the hospital, but many of them cannot talk because they've signed contracts with BP saying that they won't talk with the media. And we will go into this more in just about 20 minutes. That is Rick Outson. He's with the Independent News. That's an alternative news weekly for Northwest Florida. And now I would like to welcome Paul Magot to the show. Paul was on the ship covering the flotilla, Gaza-bound flotilla, for the Sydney Morning Herald. His first-hand account is called Terror on the Gaza Flotilla. And Paul is in Istanbul. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you this morning?
I'm okay. Thanks so much. I'm glad we were able to connect with you. I don't know if you've been following any media coverage, because the last week has been quite an ordeal for you. I understand you just landed in Istanbul yesterday?
And I think 48 hours ago is the best I can recall, but I have been focused on my own writing for the last 36 hours, so I can't say that I've had time to sit back and look at the broad coverage now.
Well, we got one email from a listener who wanted to know if, in fact, everyone has been released, because they sent us an article by Window into Palestine saying that 4 people are still being held. Do you have any information about that?
There's some confusion here. One person who I understood was insisting on staying on to legally challenge at every possible turn his position, left a voice message for me here in Istanbul this morning to say that he'd found my checkbook. So he's out. This morning I was told that an Australian dual national who had been shot in the leg and was staying on for medical treatment is now out and is here in Istanbul. There was another man who I was told wanted to fight on legally and was staying. I don't know what his status is, and I don't know if there is a fourth person.
All right, so let's talk about your piece. So you've written actually many pieces for the Sydney Morning Herald. First off, as a journalist, you were on the ship as a journalist, and there were some 60 journalists on the ship?
That is correct. I wasn't on the... I was ship-hopping, if you like. I went from there were two 25-meter cruisers in the flotilla, Challenger 1, Challenger 2. I spent the first 3 or 4 days on Challenger 2. Then I went on to the Marmara, the ship that was the focus of the most incredible part of the Israeli takeover of the flotilla. But I had stepped onto Challenger 1 in the 12 hours before the actual attack. So I was sitting about 100 meters off the Marmara when the Israeli forces struck.
Now, we had a hard time contacting you because everything has been confiscated. A number of journalists have written firsthand accounts about their cell phones, their computers. Everything has been confiscated. Have you gotten anything back?
I can't even tell you the time of day at the moment because my two watches were taken off me.
Huh. And so
my notebooks were taken off me. Absolutely everything was taken off me. I arrived in Istanbul in a pair of boxers, a pair of jeans, and a shirt. And that's all I have.
Now, you had contact with the Israeli commandos. You were held in a prison. What did they say to you when you said you were a journalist, and where are your computers, your cell phones?
We were told that journalists, there would be no respect for our rights, that we were no different to the activists on board, and notwithstanding what the Geneva Convention has to say on the rights of journalists, notwithstanding that the whole notion of embedded journalism is now accepted. I work with the American forces in Iraq, in Afghanistan. I embed with Australian forces. I go out of my way to try and talk to other groups, insurgency groups around the world, to try and understand them. I mean, one of the big things about journalism these days is it is so broad and so all pervasive that you have to be able to get into all sides of a story so that people can understand it. There's a lovely notion that if you don't tell half of a story, only one half of it becomes an accepted fact. There's a belief that you don't need to examine the other side of a story to know where to stand, to know how the story is going to play out, to know what the dynamic is about. I went on the flotilla because I thought it was going to be a fascinating story, a fascinating opportunity to look at the whole dynamic of the Gaza story. And I was not alone in that. There were not a lot of what you might call Western mainstream or English mainstream language journalists amongst those there, but there was a good number, and it was worth, as the story has proved, it was worth being there as a journalist.
Your colleague, a photographer, she, I read, was tased. She said she did everything she could to keep her cards. And a few of the photos have been shown on your website. Can you talk a little bit about what her experience was like?
This is my colleague, Kate Geraghty, who is one of Australia's leading news photographers. She's twice been voted Photographer of the Year. She's a sensational young professional, and I have to say she's a joy to work with on the road. We were on the we sat about 150 meters off the Marmara as it was boarded, and then the skipper of the boat that we were on decided to make a break for it because ours was the fastest boat in the fleet. We were up on the flybridge as the Israeli assault craft moved in around us. Even before they came on to our boat, Kate was standing up shooting shots of them coming on. And the next minute, there was a flash of light, a white flash. She felt this incredible blast on her arm, her upper arm, where she was holding the camera up. She didn't drop the camera, but she was thrown across the deck by the force of this shock. She's got a great big welt on her arm, but otherwise is fine. For us working for the Australian media, the next minute was a revealing moment for us because the first three commandos to address us on the flying bridge as they tumbled onto the flying bridge spoke in broad Australian accents.
Well, hold that thought. That's Paul McGough with the Sydney Morning Herald. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, San Francisco, your local public radio station. Coming up tonight at 5 o'clock, it's Left, Right, and Center with Robert Shear, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington looking at the news events of the week, followed by a Counterspin, and then at 8 o'clock, My Word and My Music from the BBC and Fascinating Rhythm. Java Jive is this week's theme on the Fascinating Rhythm. And at 10, it's Voice Box with Chloe Veltman. And Music from Other Minds follows at 10. On your local public radio station, KALW, San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. On Monday, we will have a debate about the PG&E-backed Proposition 16, which would significantly raise the bar and make it difficult for cities and counties that want to get into the business of offering public power to citizens. That's on Monday. And we vote, just a reminder, on Tuesday. And if you have a show idea for us or an overall comment, you can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. And Paul Mago is joining us from Istanbul. He was, as he said, sort of boat hopping on the Gaza-bound flotilla. He is a foreign correspondent with the Sydney Morning Herald. And as you can imagine, Paul has been through quite an ordeal over the last few days. So we're going to let him go in just about 10 minutes. So if you have a question for Paul about what he saw on the boat, his reporting, he hasn't had that much time to look at other reporting. But if you have any comments about what you've read, what you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. Later in the show, we'll talk about continuing coverage of the oil disaster, as well as violence in Afghanistan and Pakistan. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're also joined today by the Independent News' Rick Outson. That's an alternative news weekly for Northwest Florida. And Protap Chatterjee. He is senior editor of Corp Watch. And Protap, did you want to jump in there?
I did, actually. I've been reading Paul's excellent coverage, and I'm actually curious because I've been looking in vain for the last four days to see who it is that had died. And I noticed here that three of the names that Paul named, Sura Fakhrizaz, I think, was an Indonesian cameraman, a Turkish journalist, Çetin Cengiz, and finally a Turkish photographer was shot in the back of the head. It sounds like a lot of the people that were killed or attacked were actually journalists. I'm wondering if Paul can comment on this. And then also a technical question, had I been on the ship and had I tried to, let's say, keep an SD card from a camera to keep some of my footage. Could I have kept that, or would have that been completely impossible because the Israelis seized all footage from the media?
Paul, were you able to hear Protap?
There was a bit of an echo on the last half of the question about discs and footage, if you could repeat that for me, please.
Sure. He wanted to find out if he had one of these cards on him on the ship, would he have been able to keep that, or was everything taken?
Several people managed, Kate managed to smuggle her stuff out beautifully. My photographer colleague, she has various ways of doing that, and it worked. I spoke to a Serbian cameraman yesterday who was telling me that as he was sort of held on the deck being guarded by the Israeli forces, he was actually able to unpick the waistband, sections of the waistband of his boxers, and create little pockets where he was able to slip the discs. And he had six of those discs, and he got all but one of them out. The one that he had on the back of his boxes, which he'd put in earlier, was discovered. The other five he managed to get out.
And then Protap also wanted to find out about the nine people who've been killed. Based on your reporting, it sounds like a few of these people were journalists.
Well, that's often the way. Journalists are the ones who move around to try and see as much of as they can of an evolving story, and that inevitably puts them at greater risk. I don't know whether he's implying in his question that they were singled out. I can't say that, and I'm not saying that, but that's what his suggestion implies, an either-or there. I do know that journalists inevitably are at greater risk to the extent that it's curiosity that drives them and keeps them in a dangerous situation.
I found a page with photos of the people who've been killed. Some of them have Facebook pages. There are links to their Facebook pages. You write about a 45-year-old woman, Gidem Tagush, a Turkish woman. She was shown a picture of her dead husband, you write, and she became catatonic. And then after she talked a little bit about it, held him in her arms, several witnesses recounted how she accepted condolences and then threw herself into helping other injured people.
This woman's behavior was one of those, you know, in a crisis like this, there are always points of absolute amazement. And three or four different people, as I did my interviews, raised her performance as something quite remarkable. Her husband had died in her arms, and she literally took condolences for 4, 5, 10 minutes, laid her husband's body down on the deck, and then threw herself into first aid for everybody else who needed it. It was, by all accounts, a superhuman effort by her.
And Paul, the first few days after this happened, the media did sort of treat this as a video fight. The Israelis released one video, the activists released another video. What are your thoughts about how the media dealt with that? And then also, can you corroborate some of the claims by a British activist, an Al Jazeera English reporter, and many others who said that when the commandos were coming down from the ropes, they were shooting on the boats as they were coming down?
I can't corroborate any claims expressly about the shooting. As I was told by activists who were on the deck, let's face it, as far as they were concerned, they were protecting their ship in international waters. What they did was, as the first commandos came down, they actually grabbed them before they touched the deck. So they were. It was for them. It was like picking fruit almost in terms of being able to do something as they saw to protect their ship. There is an allegation by the Israelis that as they grabbed these guys, they took their weapons and turned them on the other commandos coming down and on the helicopters. None of the activists have verified that in any way, and to a certain extent, the Israelis would say, well, they wouldn't, would they? Two people told me that that the weapons that were confiscated were immediately thrown overboard. Several activists have volunteered that the first commandos that came down that were grabbed in this fashion were beaten, but that leaders beaten with punches, in terms of the allegations of whether iron bars were used, I was told that at that point they weren't used, that fists were thrown, but that the leaders of the activist movement did move in to shelter these people who were captured and that they were given medical treatment. Now, what you're going to, what you've got is story and counter-story. It's one of those classic situations where a narrative will form and an accepted narrative may or may not emerge that will be believed. What I sense is going to happen out of all of this is that there will be a goldstone moment in this whole exercise. People on the boat have got their 700-plus witnesses who will come forward with stories. The Israelis will come forward with stories, and somebody will be believed. I mean, one of the interesting things about the whole Middle East crisis these days is control of the narrative. And one of the most amazing exercises in terms of control of the narrative recently that we have observed was the Mossad assault on the Hamas operative in Dubai in January, where Dubai, because of what it was able to put into the public space by way of data, imagery, and accounts of what has happened, stole control of the narrative completely. In a sense, it ceased to matter whether what the Dubai authorities said was right or wrong. Because they were able to put so much information out, it became the accepted, believable account of what had happened.
Well, Paul, we know you want to get some rest. We're just going to take two brief calls, and then we'll let you go. Let's hear from Molly in Monterey. Hi, Molly. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much. I'm just very curious the extent to which this Turkish government, which is moving away from the secular tradition, is trying to shame the military by provoking Israel, how much that would be part of what was going on.
Paul Mago?
Well, undoubtedly, Turkish government is positioning itself as a force in the region, as every other government can and will. The Turkish government these days will tell you that one of the flaws in the Turkish democracy has been the power of the military, that the military has enforced its view on what the government, the elected government, could or couldn't do over the years. And the government here would argue now that it is exercising the democratic will of the people, not the military exercising the military's self-appointed view of what the people should think. There's a fascinating political dynamic emerging in this part of the world now where, and if you look at the role of Iran, Iran has used the Palestinian case to further its interests against the power of the other Arab governments in the region. The Turks are doing something similar, and they're doing it in a way that is very believable and very plausible. And what they're also doing is they are showing up the Arab governments in particular for their never-ending manipulation of the Palestinian case to their own ends without ever doing anything to substantively address the core issue and to carry through on what the Arab street, as you often hear, in terms of what the Arab population think about the issue in terms of resolving it.
All right. Thank you for the call, Molly. And we have time for one more caller. Let's go to Ed in Berkeley. Hi, Ed. We don't have much time.
Sure.
But go ahead.
Just how shallow is the American media covering the whole episode, especially they never showed up what's inside the ship. Even the Jerusalem Post have said an article say stupid, stupid, stupid about the action. And, you know, another way, another turn for Israel to be its own worst enemy. That was the most stupid thing that you could have done because it brought the Richard Corey thing back in the news. It brought the U.S. celebrity attack back in the news. And really, with stupidity as the Israeli government have been, who needs an enemy for Israel? Israel have been the worst enemy for itself, and all of the pro-Israeli groups that approve Israel action, regardless, are the most stupid friend Israel could have. You know, and the time is not on the side of Israel. With many episodes like that, you have the whole world against it. If you Google search the worst brand name in the world, the first word will come out.
All right,
Israel.
Ed.
Thank you,
Paul. Before we let you go, what about the Rachel Corrie ship that's on its way? There are some reports that say it might land on tomorrow or over the weekend. Any idea how that ship will be?
The last I heard was about 150 kilometers off Gaza. Now it's going to be fascinating to watch how this plays out. Whether the Israelis will try to reshape their position or whether they will hold the line, their line. So far they're saying they will hold their line. There's some very special people on that ship. How it is treated and whether it's allowed to get in will be one of those moments in a fascinating and twisting story.
Well, Paul, I know you want to go get some rest, and are you going to stay in Istanbul for
I'll be here for the next few days before I work out where my next destination is.
Well, we'd love to have you on again soon.
Anytime.
Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. That is Paul McGough. He is chief foreign correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald. You can find his piece, as well as many others. He actually has written many pieces in the last few days. His latest is Terror on the Gaza Flotilla. He was on the ship covering the story, along with a few of his colleagues for the Sydney Morning Herald. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. And today we are also joined by Protop Chatterjee. He is senior editor of Corp Watch, and Protop is actually going to be in town next Thursday speaking about Afghanistan and Pakistan at UC Berkeley at 7 o'clock, and you can find information at yourcallradio.org. We are also joined by Rick Outzen, publisher and editor of Independent News. That's the alternative news weekly for Northwest Florida. We're now getting reports that waves of gooey tar balls are crashing into the white sands of the Florida Panhandle. Rick is following this closely. He's also out with a piece called BP's Windfall to the Rich. It's about a BP program to hire cleanup boats rather than hire boats from fishermen. According to Rick's investigations, the company is hiring boats owned by the wealthy. And we've got a few calls on the oil disaster. Before we get to that, Rick, I understand that media are now converging on Florida, and there have been some editorials. The Chronicle, Houston Chronicle, just wrote a piece saying that one of the most disturbing aspects of BP's handling of the explosion and subsequent oil disaster are the company's attempts to restrict media coverage. It says BP officials seem to be more adept at cutting off information flows than oil leaks. What's been your experience?
Well, I thought Paul's comments on the control of the narrative is what he is seeing in Tel Aviv and where the part of the world that he's in is definitely what BP's approach has been with this. We're seeing that huge security around any of the staging areas now. Everyone has to be badged. We know that in Louisiana they have limited access to areas, to the wildlife refuge areas that are there, so that no one can get an accurate count on how many birds and sea turtles and have been killed by this. We cannot even get the BP representatives here in Pensacola to tell us what their cleanup plan is for these tar balls that are hitting our beach right now. It's very much in lockdown mode, I've written about it for the Daily Beast. I was one of the first reporters ever kicked out of a meeting, which is sort of, I guess, my claim to fame. But the whole reason that I was in the meeting, it was supposed to be an operational meeting to tell us how they were going to prepare for this, and this was back on May 1st, and they did not want the media in the room, and it was an interesting confrontation, but it's escalated much more since then, and now the other media are seeing it too.
Well, we have a few callers on this. Let's hear from Kim in San Francisco. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the show.
Going to the details of the oil spill, one thing journalists have not questioned is the buzzword boom. We see in images the bright orange length of these plastic floating pontoons. They have a long 3-foot skirt that hangs below in the water. And it's assumed that, okay, it's out there. Harry Shearer, NPR's one of NPR's people on the radio, had aired audio Sunday from a boom expert explaining that, number one, there is not enough boom in the world to properly contain the oil in the Gulf, that BP has not hired professional boom companies, but is in fact using untrained workers to do the job. Boom is supposed to be anchored, and it's supposed to be overlapping. Clearly from the photos, it's not. We see it floating everywhere. Officials, including President Obama, are flown out, and all they see is this long string of orange-colored boom, and they're told, okay, it's out there, we're deploying it. And journalists are not questioning any of the 100 boom experts in the world. It is not being used in a way that it could possibly work. It's ludicrous technology, yet it's aired as though, okay, this is one step in the chain.
Well,
I'll stop.
Sure.
The Coast Guard's Admiral Thad Allen is basically acting as a mouthpiece and repeating BP's press releases. There are 100 boom experts in the world. Some journalists, please go talk to them.
Well, thank you. And this is where video just is so powerful. CNN actually rowed out on a boat and found that there were maybe 3 boats where there should be at least 100. And they're literally taking the boom and putting it in bags and then putting out new boom. And in some cases, they were actually, and Rick, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, they were actually sort of cleaning off oil-drenched grasses. I mean, it was kind of pathetic, actually.
It really, truly is pathetic. And it is a situation, and I understand exactly where the caller is coming from, in that the boom has been one of the things that BP, from the very beginning, as they began their spin on this, was every meeting, when a spokesman stood up, they told us how much boom they had deployed that day and what they had in waiting and what they were going to put out next. And BP CEO Tony Hayward was in essence bragging about this 3 weeks ago, about how that they had this contained, that it hadn't, they'd done a great job of keeping it from reaching the shore, and all of that was just part of controlling the narrative. I was speaking to a local operation here today there's so many experts out there on boom. We have experts here locally that BP is not using. They have their own contracted people who sign waivers that they will not speak on what they're doing, And The Boom has been one of these things that there was a great show, a great picture. They took credit that that was keeping it off our shores, when in essence it really was the tides were working against it coming to the shore, and now the winds have changed and the tide is working differently, and now we don't hear them talking about how much boom they have out there.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Ken. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We've got Rick Outzen on the line. He is publisher and editor of Independent News, the alternative news weekly for Northwest Florida. We're now getting reports that waves of gooey tar balls are crashing into the white sands of the Florida Panhandle. And Protop Chatterjee, a senior editor of Corp Watch. And Protop, I got an email from a listener who sent a piece called BP Disaster is Cheney's Katrina. The lead in this piece, it's by the Center for American Progress, says BP's oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico is without a doubt former VP Dick Cheney's Katrina. President Bush and Cheney consistently catered to big oil and other special interests to undercut renewable energy and energy and efficiency initiatives that would set the U.S. on a more secure and clean energy path. And it's a timeline of from 2001, all of the meetings that Cheney had with the energy industry, the behind the closed door meetings. And it's a pretty extensive article. And you're starting to hear more about Halliburton specifically this week. What are your thoughts on that angle?
Well, that's interesting. They bring up Bush and Cheney. I mean, like most of these companies, whether it's Halliburton or BP, they always, you know, do their best to pay off whoever's in charge. So if the Republicans are in charge, they'll give them money. If the Democrats are in charge, they'll give them money. There was an interesting story that was came out a few years ago where Cheney, basically as CEO of Halliburton, you know, worked with the Clinton administration, people in the State Department, to try and get BP a contract in Siberia by lobbying people that he knew there. So it's not at all surprising that we're hearing these stories. To me, in some ways, I think one of the stories that I think people are not reporting on, except I want to give praise here for one particular reporter in London, John Bidal, the environment editor of the Guardian, is this story, horrifying as it is in fact something that is actually played out every single day in the Niger Delta and in Ecuador. These kinds of spills happen throughout the rainforest region of the Ecuador and Amazon and the sort of fragile ecosystems of the Niger Delta by oil companies, and it's hardly ever reported on. Today, not because, you know, and this is in no way to say that this is worse or better because it's hitting Pensacola, but where is the international media when these gooey tar balls wash up, you know, in indigenous lands throughout the world?
And McClatchy had a similar article about that, saying that this happens on a regular basis, like you said, in the Niger Delta, also in Alberta, Canada. And on Tuesday's show, we're actually going to talk about long-term environmental impacts of this. And also, Protop, I just wanted to also mention that the Huffington Post has a piece by Tom Hartman called Halliburton and BP, Is It Time for the Corporate Death Penalty? And then the Wall Street Journal is reporting that Halliburton may be a primary suspect in the investigation into the oil rig explosion that has devastated the coast. There's also some stories about Halliburton giving members of Congress, mostly Republicans, some money, although it's not that much. You're talking $10,000 here, $30,000 there. They gave that to members of the House that might be investigating. And this happened over the last month.
Well, BP actually has lagged behind some of the bigger American companies that have put money into pockets of Congress people. And just to reiterate this, however, that they have been very involved with Dick Cheney in the past. This is the company I'm recalling now, is Tioman Oil Company in Siberia, and Cheney went to bat for them when he was CEO of Halliburton. But it's, you know, it's sort of par for the course when oil companies you know may lose business, they try to take they put money in the pockets of politicians. But also they try to, as Rick was pointing out, you know, try to take control of the narrative. And what more amazing than BP's statements perhaps 10 years ago when they relabeled themselves under John Brown as Beyond Petroleum. I'm recalling actually a friend from Sacramento's book called Who Owns the Sun. 15 years ago, two companies bought up the solar industry, the majority of the solar industry at the time in the United States. I don't know if it was, there were some conspiracy theorists who said it was because they want to shut down the solar industry. Others, you know, that suggested it was because they figured it was going to be profitable in the future. The two companies were British Petroleum and Enron. Those are the two companies who tried to take control of the narrative because they figured, you know, well, with global warming and things like that, they needed to be able to prove that they were good citizens. Well, now post the Texas City oil refinery deaths, you know, the deep water situation right now, we can see that, in fact, BP is no different from any of the other oil companies, whether it's Exxon or Shell.
All right. Well, thanks again for the call, Ken. And let's next go to John in Berkeley. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I would like to find that that was a very interesting segue. There's a saying by Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, never let a crisis go to waste. And contrary to Mr. Obama's feigned outrage, this week, the U.S. Minerals Management Service has approved another offshore oil lease in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, these moratoriums that Mr. Obama talks about are only temporary because it is still the stated policy of the Obama administration to continue offshore oil drilling. And while this may be a black eye for Obama, the fact of the matter is that Republican or Democrat, these administrations are still beholden to the energy industry. There is a saying by Voltaire, when it comes to money, everyone is of the same religion. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thank you. Do you have any information about that, Rick? Because I read a story that said that possibly that wasn't the case. They were going to wait on that.
They are. From what we understand, there is a moratorium that's going to be placed. I know in Louisiana they're very concerned about it because not only would they lose their fishing industry, but they would lose the offshore drilling, which is for Louisiana. That at least that's within their state waters is important. You know, I think a good point was just brought up, though, about the oil industry as a whole. One of the questions that I have started to ask and other reporters have started to ask is, where are the rest of the oil companies in this? If in any other industry, if we had a catastrophe of this sort, you would see some unification come together as like an old country barn burning where everyone comes to help try to put out the fire. No one else has showed up to help. No one, either BP has kept them away or they themselves have stayed away from this. And I think that is very concerning to several of us. And I think the other part that's we're starting to hear is whether or not the federal government, even the state governments, have the opportunity to go after BP and Halliburton under RICO statutes, whether or not this is, RICO is Racketeering Influenced Corrupt Organizations Act. Do we have has our government been compromised by the oil industry? Were they not regulated properly? And have we been lied to by the safety of these facilities, as well as whether or not they had the proper contingency plans in place if an accident were to happen? And this is going to escalate beyond just trying to arrest, you know, the engineer on site that may be messed up. But this could be much more damaging to the oil industry as a whole if we start looking at it as an organized crime, a corrupt organization that has not acted with the public safety in mind.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. And there are a couple articles, one by the Journal saying that shallow water drilling permits have been rescinded. But according to other reports, the MMS has issued new Louisiana offshore oil drilling permits. And we'll put links to those articles at our site, yourcallradio.org. And just quickly, I just wanted to ask you before we switch gears here, Rick, just give us a brief overview of the piece you just wrote for the Daily Beast about BP giving these, actually hiring people who own wealthy boats, as opposed to fishermen. And you've got a quote here from a woman who says, "They have activated freaking ski boats while my husband, who has been in the charter business for 2 decades, sits idle."
Well, the Vessels of Opportunity program was set up as a lifeline for the commercial fishermen. Everyone recognized that their livelihood was going to go away. So what BP was going to do, what the program was to be, was to hire the commercial fishermen, the charter boats, and let them help with deployment of boom, locating the oil spills, because boats were going to be needed anyway. We have over 3,000 boats that have signed up into the program, but only certain boats have been activated. And when you are activated, whether you're used or not, you're paid between $1,200 and $3,000 a day, depending on the size of your boat. Your crew, your deckhands are each given $200 a day. So it could really help a commercial fisherman or a charter boat. But what's happened is 90% in some of these areas, particularly Biloxi, Mississippi, 90% of the boats that have been activated have been these weekend warriors, these pleasure boats owned by doctors, lawyers, chiropractors, people who make their living during the week doing other things, while the charter boats and the commercial fishing boats are sitting idle in the dock. And we started here in Pensacola, and then I started moving along the Gulf Coast, calling the heads of the different charter associations. And uniformly along the Gulf Coast, every one of them were seeing the same problems. They had notified BP. BP has yet to act on this, and this has really surfaced over the last 3 weeks. And it's not a difficult process. All the databases are available for anyone online to see who's a commercial fisherman or charter boat because of the licensing situation. They actually activated 3 sailboats. That's how little attention they were paying to it in the very beginning. Fortunately, they took them off, but it's as if they were checking off a box. We have this program. We want to take credit for it. Go out and sign as many boats as you can and not really worry about the details. Mm.
Well, and you can read Rick's in-depth piece at yourcallradio.org. And we have about 5 minutes left, shifting gears here. Protap Chatterjee, the oil disaster and the Gaza-bound flotillas have dominated media headlines this week. Afghanistan and Pakistan have not received that much attention, although the drones have received some attention. What are your thoughts? I mean, what do you think are some of the most important narratives going on right now? Wired magazine just reported that the U.S. military is spending hundreds of millions of dollars on wartime encampments. By one account, the U.S. and its allies have 700 bases in Afghanistan. And then a piece coming out of the Telegraph today says that Taliban prisoners could be released in an attempt to broker a peace deal under a recommendation made by a meeting of the 1,600-strong peace jirga in Afghanistan.
Rose, I haven't seen the Wired piece. I'm trying to look it up right now. I'm wondering if it's by Noah Schachtman.
Yes, it is.
He does really, really amazing coverage. And what's amazing is, I don't know if he and Spencer Ackerman of the Washington Independent, as far as I can tell, actually report largely from Washington. Spencer's been to Afghanistan, but they do an amazing job of discovering things right here, you know, in the capital. And I want to, since you know, we're talking about media coverage, point out another reporter who's actually done a sterling job, and with that actually talk about the control of the narrative. And that's Chris Chivers, who goes by CJ Chivers of the New York Times. He has a piece that came out a couple of days ago that says, Afghan police earn poor grade for Marja mission. It's about how, and you will recall in the early days of this year in January, how there was this amazing, spectacular, you know, conquest of a small part of the Helmand province in Afghanistan, where American soldiers were able to, you know, take control, where they were going to destroy the Taliban, destroy the opium, you know, and bring democracy. And yet today, you know, 4 or 5 months later, those that have stuck around, like Chivers, who was there through the whole time, was there before and is there now after, is actually saying that's not really true. The police that have been sent there are completely incompetent. And this, mind you, is not the regular police who we accept are incompetent, but the Afghan National Civil Order Police, which is supposed to be the country's best. We also note, there have been a bunch of reports, actually, that have also noticed that the Americans are now guarding the opium in Marja. So despite the fact that they sent 15,000 Afghan and American and allied soldiers into Marja to, you know, occupy a land of some an area with 50,000 to 100,000 people, they still are not able to prevent the Taliban from there. So what are they, what's going to happen in Kandahar? And, you know, we're expected to hear about this surge in Kandahar, yet the Taliban have been able to launch attacks on the Kandahar base. I think they did that on May 22nd, on the Bagram base on May 19th. They attacked the Peace Jirgah just 2 days ago on June 3rd. You know, they attacked an American convoy and killed six relatively senior soldiers on May 18th. So this narrative, you know, flies in the face of what Obama has claimed is going to be, you know, a successful mission. You look at the information from the State Department and the Pentagon. Afghanistan is no less dangerous. In fact, it's marginally more dangerous than it was a year ago. So what has happened? Why has he not been able to seize control? And I think some of the answers are because they have relied so heavily on this sort of clandestine secret war, you know, drone strikes from above, night raids, and those don't actually help. They hinder, to put out, you know, kudos where kudos are due. I want to highlight a story by Gareth Porter of Interpress Service, where he interviews Jeremy Aldicott, a former JAG, that's a judge advocate general, a military lawyer, who's been talking to a lot of CIA drone operators. These are not the heads of the CIA. These are the sort of rank-and-file people. And they're saying they are opposed to the drone strikes. Now, presumably they're in favor of surveillance because they're the CIA, but they themselves, people, you know, at the bottom ranks of the CIA are saying these strikes are actually harming us. It's actually giving al-Qaeda more ammunition to say the Americans, you know, are cowards, they fight from the sky, they're unaccountable, they kill civilians. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it's really about what people in Pakistan perceive. And if they believe, or in Afghanistan, if they believe the Americans are attacking them, the United States has lost the war. But the U.S. is really, you know, it's not being able to control that narrative. All it's been able to be successful at is convincing the mainstream media in the United States while failing on the ground. I mean,
Pratap, we're almost out of time, but what are you working on right now?
I continue to work on issues in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I just published a story about a month or so ago looking at the training of the Afghan police. I'll return to Afghanistan in a couple of months to look at that. I will actually start to turn my attention to the drone strikes and the federal territories, federal autonomous territories in northern Pakistan, looking at USAID's operations.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of town, Pratap, but we will definitely have you back soon. And Pratap will be in town next Thursday. Find information at yourcallradio.org. Pratap Chatterjee is with Corp Watch, and Rick Outson is with the Independent News. Thank you both for joining us. Thanks for listening. I'll be right back to let you know what's coming up tomorrow. All right. Monday. What's the future of public electricity in California? On the next Your Call, we'll have a debate about Proposition 16 on the June 8th ballot. The PG&E-backed proposition would make it incredibly difficult for cities and counties that want to offer public power. So what's the current state of public power in California? Join us live at 11 or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. What would municipal power offer that private companies like PG&E don't? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
Hello, I'm Chloe Veltman, and I'd like to tell you about VoiceBox, KALW's great music series, an eclectic exploration of the art of singing and the best of the vocal music scene from the Bay Area and beyond. Composing music for voices requires a lot of talent and skill. Talent can't be taught, but certain skills can. On this week's show, David Conti, professor of composition at the San Francisco Conservatory, and two of his students, Anthony Porter and Joseph Stilwell, join me in the studio for a discussion about what it's like to write vocal works early in your career. So please tune in next Friday at 10 p.m. here on KALW 91.7 FM San Francisco.
And that's actually tonight at 10 o'clock here on...